My guest on Takes on the World today, Professor Linda Bilmes, is the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Senior Lecturer in Public Policy and a full-time faculty member at the Harvard Kennedy School, where she teaches budgeting, cost accounting, and public finance. She is widely considered one of the leading experts in U.S. budgeting and public finance and has held senior positions in the government, including Assistant Secretary and Chief Financial Officer of the U.S. Department of Commerce during the Clinton administration, and has served on a number of high-level national commissions. Professor Bilmes was also one of four individuals selected by the U.S. Congress in 2010 as a candidate for Comptroller General of the United States. She is co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of the New York Times bestseller, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict, about which I interviewed her in 2008, and co-author with W. Scott Gould of The People's Factor, Strengthening America by Investing Public Service. She is well known for her work on the cost of war and veterans issues, including the landmark paper, Soldiers Returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, The Long-Term Cost of Providing Veterans Medical Care, Disability Benefits. Professor Bilmes is a frequent guest on national TV and radio broadcast and was featured in Charles Ferguson's Academy Award nominated documentary film No End in Sight and in Rethinking Afghanistan by Brave New Films. She's a recipient of 2008 Speaking Truth to Power Award for the American Friends Service Committee, and although I have given you only a part of her remarkable accomplishments, I'm going to stop there so we can go on with the show. Welcome once again, Professor Linda Bilmes, to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much.
Happy to have you here again. I have in my hands, or a couple of my hands here, The Financial Legacy of Iraq and Afghanistan, How Wartime Spending Decisions Will Constrain Future National Security Budgets, a detailed report that you recently prepared on the true cost of the war to the American people for the Kennedy Center. It far exceeds the earlier projections that you made with Joseph Stiglitz. In preparing the paper, you are certainly speaking truth to power. My question is, will those in power get it, particularly in Congress, or say, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead?
Well, I think that that's an interesting question. And while I'm not sure that they will see it the way that I have seen it, what is already happening is that those who are in charge of the Defense Department and at the Department of Veterans Affairs and other departments throughout the government are looking at these long-term costs. They're looking at the costs of the war. They're looking at the cost of financing the war. They're looking at the long-term costs, and they are wondering how they are going to manage to fund other national security projects, given the fact that the legacy of the war are these long-term costs that no one had budgeted for or anticipated.
Do you think this is one of the reasons that President Obama picked Senator Hagel for his Secretary of Defense? Because Senator Hagel is a veteran, and he is evidently willing to make cuts?
Well, it's not as easy as just making cuts, because when you go into any kind of situation where you take over a budget, you're always inheriting the legacy of decisions that were made in the past. And in this case, what has happened is that over the last decade, we've made a number of decisions. Many of them are wise decisions about the way we would care for our veterans and the kind of benefits that we would provide to those who have fought the war. But we are basically dealing now with the fact that we didn't pay for any of these things yet. So all of these promises, in addition to the fact that the entire war has been put on the national credit card because we've borrowed the $2 trillion that we have spent to date, we have put another $2 trillion kind of on the deferred compensation category. So we got another $2 trillion on the credit card to go. And when the Defense Department looks at the choices it needs to make, for example, how many troops do we need to have as opposed to how much do we want to rely on drones and unmanned robotic warfare, it is being pushed into a situation where the people costs are too expensive because of all of the sort of legacy costs of pensions and medical care benefits and military pay and compensation decisions that were taken over the last 10 years in order to encourage the all-volunteer force to fight these wars.
Well, the number of startling statistics and troubling statistics in your report, but the one that jumped out to me the most was the fact that 56% of the 1.56 million troops who fought in Afghanistan and Iraq, that's 87 million or more than a quarter of American society, have already applied or eligible, have already applied actually for disability under the medical system, veterans benefits, and this number is not going to go down. It's an extraordinary number, and as I look at this, it might be that your estimate, even current estimates, are low.
Well, it may be, and when Joe Stiglitz and I wrote started our original work in 2005 and 2006, we were initially basing our projections of the war on previous wars, and we know that wars always have long-term costs. They always do. The peak year for paying disability benefits for World War I was in 1969. And the peak year for paying disability benefits for World War II was in 1986. And we haven't reached the peak year for paying Vietnam veteran benefits yet. But in this war, in addition to the fact that there is always this lag, you have a much higher survival rate, you have much more generous benefits, you have a much more open policy at the VA for encouraging people to apply for benefits, and you have a war that has been fought by a small part of the population and has been characterized by very long deployments, multiple deployments, very short dwell times, that's the time between deployments, so an enormous strain on those who have actually fought the war. And this has led to very high utilization rate of the medical services, both in the military and in the veterans department, and to a very, very high rate of applications for disability claims. More than 50%, as you mentioned, of those who have been discharged to date have already claimed disability benefits. 97% of those benefits are approved when they go through the system. And the complexity of these benefits is staggering. The complexity is, on average, 8 different disabling conditions per claim, as opposed to 2.5 disabling conditions per claim during Vietnam. So you have a enormous legacy of benefits, payments, compensation, and suffering for those who have been fighting these wars.
Of course, the improved battle armor or body armor, Kevlar body armor, that has kept a number of those soldiers from being killed, has left them maimed, quadriplegic, or at least in the need of prosthetics, or mentally damaged, whereas in other wars they would have simply been dead. So in a certain way, so many of those soldiers are alive because of modern medical techniques, but they will be on disability and essentially living less than full lives as humans for the rest of their lives.
Well, I mean, yes, absolutely, you're right that modern medicine has been extraordinary. And the one benefit, as it were, of the war has been enormous advances in prosthetic technology. And I have a book that's about to come out on Walter Reed Hospital. So I spent a lot of my time working with the most disabled of the veterans. But the big costs come not from that group of individuals. The big costs come from the large number of people, the hundreds of thousands of troops, who did not lose a limb, fortunately, but who have come back from the war with a variety of things that are wrong with them. So they may have come back with a loss of hearing in their left ear, with a knee that doesn't work, with a need for surgery, with a propensity to have lung problems due to exposure to some kind of chemical compound, with a back problem from having spent three tours of duty lugging around a 300-pound backpack, as well as post-traumatic stress and often at the same time traumatic brain injury. We've had more than 250,000 Americans so far diagnosed in these wars with traumatic brain injury. So these are the legacies that really endure and lead to long-term costs. And I think what's important and what I've tried to show in my most recent research is that many of these costs were the result of decisions that we took during the war. For example, I think most Americans are aware of the fact that there is an epidemic of post-traumatic stress that in the war. And one of the questions is, well, aren't wars always horrible and always stressful, and aren't people always shell-shocked, and didn't we call this something else? And to some extent, that's true, but to some extent, this war was different, because a number of retired generals have made the point to me that in previous conflicts, and many of them were commanders in Vietnam, for example, if they saw a platoon or a brigade even that was stressed out, they might assign a number of people to the proverbial peeling potatoes, to kitchen duty for a few weeks to try and de-stress that unit that had been through a very difficult situation. But now all of those kitchen jobs are done by contractors. They aren't being done by our troops. They're being done by a Sri Lankan subcontractor to a local contractor. So you don't have any wiggle room. So those folks who are actually out there fighting the fight, I mean, they are out there 100% of the time. And this has led to this extremely high mental strain in this war, in addition to all the physical strains.
Now, plus you have seen an epidemic of suicides that it seems not at all about to abate. If anything, it might increase. And
well, that's right. I mean, and the suicides are a symptom of the fact that we don't even understand what's happening, really. The Pentagon and the VA have been extremely concerned about the suicide problem. There has been an enormous amount of money thrown at this problem, and it keeps getting worse.
And also, as you mentioned, one of the costs, besides to the vets themselves, is to those of their families, their wives and their children, and what this does to the family relationships on a long-term, short and long-term. Perhaps you talk about that.
Well, that's right, because when we estimate the costs, there are costs that the government pays, like the cost of providing certain types of medical assistance, and there are costs that are borne by individuals. So the troops that come back, whether or not they are fully limbed, but they are not the same, in many cases, there are spouses or parents or family members who have to change their lives, either to give up their employment in order to become caregivers or to become primary breadwinners or to stop being breadwinners. There are children who are affected in families, and we've seen enormous consequences in terms of substance abuse, divorce, family breakups of various kind, enormously high utilization of the need for counseling among children of troops. And all of these things are the kind of hidden costs to society, which are not, they don't show up on any kind of balance sheet.
One other interesting thing, people join the National Guard or the reserves to make some extra money, but Afghanistan and Iraq appears to have totally changed the role of these two military units that are designed essentially the reserves to come back and serve the country in time of need, and the National Guard to serve the country inside the country. We saw during other periods National Guard units being sent to Central America and so on, but the consistent use of National Guard reserve troops is revealed in the statistic you showed. There's essentially not much difference in the way in terms of the numbers of the responses and what has happened physically, mentally, emotionally to National Guard members who have served in Afghanistan and Iraq and those of the regular military.
Well, this point about the National Guard is a very important point, because we have had, at some point during the last 12 years, we have had almost 50% of the fighting force being composed of reservists and guards. And we've had overall more than a third of the fighting force being composed of reservists and guards. And who are these individuals? Well, in many cases, they are a bit older, they are married, they have families, and they have joined the guards in many cases because they want to be there for disasters in their community. If there's an earthquake or a hurricane, they want to be there and help. And they hadn't anticipated going on long, repeated tours of duty in Iraq. And they also are a very expensive way for the country to fight a war, because normally we pay a National Guard, for example, we pay him or her 1 weekend a month. Now, when these individuals are mobilized for 2 years, 3 years, when they're mobilized for, on average, 2 years, we're paying them not only a full-time salary, which is what we had, for the full-time active duty troops, we're already paying them a full-time salary. But for National Guards and reservists, we're only paying them normally 1 weekend a month. So it's added a huge amount of cost, because when we have to pay them full-time, and because they are typically older and they have families, we're paying a whole range of additional benefits and combat pay and medical care and so forth. So some of the long-term costs that I was talking about that the Pentagon has to work through are the costs associated, for example, with the fact that the TRICARE system, which provides health care to the military, that the TRICARE system has expanded now to provide health care to reservists and guards and their families. And this is something which is very unlikely to be rolled back now that it's been put in place. So it's a long-term cost, and as the new healthcare law goes into effect, the Obamacare, and which will happen, this year and next, for most of those who are in this situation, it will be cheaper for them to be in the military healthcare system than even to pay the penalty, because this is very, very heavily subsidized. Now, that may not be a bad thing, but we haven't set aside any money to pay for this, and it's competing with other priorities in the military budget.
Now, I think most of the public or most of the listeners are not so aware of TRICARE as those who are in the military. Perhaps you could explain that in more detail.
Right. Well, it is very confusing if you're not in the military. For those who are in the active duty force, who are not discharged, they are not veterans, but they are serving in the active duty military, and we have 1.5 million people serving in the active duty military. The health care system that you get and your families is called TRICARE, and it's a very good and very, very heavily subsidized system, so that, for example, a family of four would pay about $250 a year for excellent health care. That's health care that would now cost about $9,000 a year if you were buying the same level of health care on the open market. So over the last 12 years, one of the things that has happened is that the co-pays and the expenses associated with TRICARE have been kept extremely low. Now, as I just explained, and the private sector healthcare prices, as any listener knows, have gone through the roof. So the difference between being enrolled in the TRICARE military system and having private health insurance has grown. So a lot more people who are eligible to be in this system have joined it. So this includes military retirees who are not discharged, but they're they're veterans, but they are people who stayed in the military for 20 years and they're discharged. So the typical trajectory is somebody joins up, say, at age 22 or 20. They serve 20 years in the military, during which they're receiving this TRICARE medical system. Then they retire at age 42 or 40. And so then for the rest of their lives, they are in the TRICARE system. So there are many, many years that this system accommodates, as well as their families. So the increases in the cost of this system, which have followed the same kind of trajectory as the much more publicized system in the veterans system, have been the same kind of things: a huge increase in claims, much higher utilization, you know, issues with getting the claims processed on time, etc. And all the costs that are associated with the very severely wounded, the amputees and the people with severe brain injuries, those are military hospitals that are part of this TRICARE system. Hospitals like Walter Reed Hospital, Army and Navy hospitals.
Well,
it's sort of like the more you understand it, the dimensions of the cost, the more you understand why we're in the realm of trillions.
My guest is Linda Bilmes, professor at Kennedy School of Government. We're talking about the cost of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I noticed that there's a section in your report about the profitability that the companies administering TRICARE, Humana, HealthNet, and TriWest Healthcare, if combined together, they'd rank as the sixth largest contractor for the Defense Department, bigger than KBR, and just below the big names like Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, and Boeing. And they account for some of the highest profits earned by any company in the war. Maybe you could elaborate on that. And who's paying for that?
Well,
we are, yeah.
Is a kind of shocking finding. You know, a couple of years ago, I wrote a paper that looked at who really profited from the Iraq War. And I had expected to find the usual suspects of Halliburton and KBR and so forth. And indeed, they were some of the companies that were on the list. But there were two other categories of private companies that had made substantial profits. One was the specialist oil manufacturing companies, for example, those that produce specialist diesel fuel for certain types of vehicles. And the second, and the category of companies with the highest profits as a result of the war, were the three companies that make up the TRICARE system. Basically because what has happened is that they have had a huge influx of additional people coming into the TRICARE system, and as a result of the fact that the government reimburses them and subsidizes the TRICARE system so heavily, as well as the demand from the wear and tear on the troops and their families, so a huge increase in utilization, huge increase in the number of prescriptions, because basically they have been able to pass on all of those costs directly to the government as part of the general big war appropriations that have been going on, there hasn't been any attention to how much they charge for a procedure compared to a private sector or another government source. So their costs, the cost of these military medical costs, have been growing faster than Medicare, faster than Medicaid, faster than the veterans' health centers, and this is the fastest growing part of the government healthcare sector. And these companies, because there are three of them, they don't show up in sort of the very top of the Pentagon contractors. But if you actually added the three of them together, they're right up there, along with Lockheed Martin and so forth, in volume. But what has really increased has been the profits, the profitability. And I think that, and I say this guardedly, but, you know, one would have to say that they are a sector that has done extremely well out of the wars, bordering on the profiteering.
Well, and as you point out here, they have absolutely no incentive to cut costs because there's no pressure on them from their friends in Congress.
Precisely.
This is a major scandal, and hopefully your report will get some of the major media to delve into this. I know you have to leave us in a few minutes, correct?
Yes, I do.
Well, I want to ask a question about the role of women in the military. There's this big push for women in combat, which I personally have to say is insane, given the information in your reports and given what we know about what's happened in the wars, aside from the sexual harassment, the rape cases and assaults and so on, that we should be supporting another sector of American society going through all this is quite amazes me. What differences do you find with the role of women in Iraq and Afghanistan in your reporting?
Well, the role of women in the all-volunteer force is a very interesting subject, and I'm just beginning, really, to grasp the dimensions of it. Women, of course, this is the first war where women have played a major role. I mean, women are now about 8% of the military, and they've been about 15% of the Iraq and Afghanistan forces. And so they have been very substantially involved, and women have, in fact, been serving in all areas of combat because one of the sort of signature issues of the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts has been that there hasn't really been a front line. So if you were a woman driving a truck in a military convoy, you were on the front line. You were certainly very likely to get hit and you know, took many of the risks, shouldered many of the risks alongside the guys. However, there are some very disturbing findings that are coming out of my research on women. Women veterans who are returning from these wars have higher rates of unemployment, higher rates of suicide, higher rates of homelessness, higher rates of divorce, higher rates of depression, higher rates of almost any negative social thing you can imagine. And the question that we're trying to work on is why? Why is this happening? And I don't have the causal answer yet, but we are finding some differences in looking at who are the women who go into the military compared with the men. Women tend to be younger. Women tend to be less likely to come from a military family. Women tend to be, from, on average, a slightly lower socioeconomic family background than men. Women tend to be a more diverse group in terms of ethnicity than the men. And so there are a whole range of issues to look at. And to date, very few people have been studying this issue. The only studies have really been in the medical field, where a number of medical researchers have been studying issues like what is the correlation between military sexual trauma and homelessness and things like that. But although I think the military is very concerned about some of these findings, and I personally have presented some of these findings at the highest levels, what is known is that the issue of military sexual trauma does not explain many of the findings that we see, and that there is a lot of research to go in order to try and understand it.
Well, this is something that really needs to be explored. I've watched this, and I see the campaign being made to justify women in combat, as you mentioned. Every time they're driving on a truck and they run over an IED, they're just like the men in that situation. But I do hope that there is more information and more research on this, and people will understand that it's better not having these wars in the first place. As I say, I know you did have to go.
Yes, I do.
Do you have any last comment for our listeners?
Well, I think that thank you very much for inviting me on your show. My last comment is simply that we see from the war that the concept of understanding long-term costs and understanding the legacy of these costs is very strongly found in my findings. And one of the things that I have been recommending for a long time is that we should be appropriating money for the care of veterans at the same time that we appropriate war funding. So if we go to war, we know there are going to be these inevitable long-term costs of caring for those who fight the war. So we should be appropriating essentially 1.5 times the money, because that would, first of all, price the war more correctly, which should, if economics works, should be a disincentive to go to war by pricing it at a more truthful cost. And secondly, it then would ensure that we don't run out of money to take care of those who have shouldered these burdens once we've asked them to do it.
Well, Professor Linda Bilmes, I want to thank you very much for being our guest and speaking about this very, very difficult subject. And I'm looking forward to your new book coming out, you say?
I have a book coming out that is looking at the Walter Reed Hospital and how we have treated the rehabilitation, the prosthetics, and all the things going on with some of the severely wounded in these wars.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today and keeping on top of the subject.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.